I think that science can offer a better world, and in fact, a world that's more ethical. Science is based on telling the truth, which is a really important ethical boundary. It's one that I don't think religion shares, in fact.
I think if you are a devoutly religious person and someone who accepts the scientific method, something's gotta give. Whenever science succeeds, religion loses.
And my question is, as we get more advanced in science, does it hurt our belief in God?
All this time we've been thinking about God, we were thinking about the wrong thing. We should have focused our energies and thought and our intellect on the universe. We should have been thinking not about God, but about the physical universe. The physical universe as opposed to what? God.
How long are we going to have to fight this? People are just not getting the memo. This belief that there is a conflict between science and religion, or that science has removed God as an explanation for the universe, we continue to see this everywhere. I saw it today on an online forum for a major news organization. Several people there saying, I don't need God, I've got science. Well, Dr. Craig, I wish everyone would read this article that we're going to look at today. Everyone who thinks that there's a conflict between science and religion, or science versus philosophy. I know we've talked a lot about this, Bill, but let's continue to address it because it keeps coming up. And even though we've addressed it a lot on these podcasts, I think there is always fresh perspectives that you can bring and outstanding writing like this article.
And so we're going to look at an article by Roger Trigg, who is professor of philosophy emeritus at the University of Warwick in England, and so a philosopher of some eminence.
Yeah, he was the founding president of the British Philosophical Association. And the name of this article is Why Science Needs Metaphysics, byline, Science Can't Tell Us Whether Science Explains Everything. We'll begin, let's once again define metaphysics.
Well, metaphysics will be a philosophical inquiry into the nature of ultimate reality. What is the nature of the world, not simply on a scientific level, but ultimately?
I wonder how it got mischaracterized to the extent that when you go to the bookstore, you go to the New Age section and it's
right.
Ghosts and goblins and things like that. People have that mistaken identity.
Right. Somehow metaphysics got connected with New Age mysticism, and that's not classically the way it's been used. Perhaps that's a result of verificationism in the first half of the 20th century, which attempted to expel metaphysics from philosophy as a meaningless exercise and wanted to simply allow science to dictate to us the way reality ultimately is. And in a sense, what Trigg is reacting to is that old-line verificationist approach, which would exalt science over metaphysics and philosophy.
He says, theories are more underdetermined by empirical results than ever, but scientists are reluctant to admit that the arguments that they put forward are philosophical and metaphysical. Their theories provide a framework in which they can operate, but they are removed not only from actual observation, but from what in principle can be accessible to us, our descendants, or even any possible observer in our universe. It is hard to see that they are anything other than the product of pure reason. Just because scientists use reasoning does not make it science, but the gist of this that I just read, Bill, is that he apparently detects this reluctance to admit that philosophy is what they're doing quite often as scientists. So it's not just us, it's not just others who have been jumping up and down on this.
That's right. And it is ironic because sometimes these same persons will decry philosophy as a pointless and empty discipline, which is no good and serves no purpose. And yet, if Trigg is right, they actually are themselves, unwittingly perhaps, engaged in philosophical and metaphysical pursuits.
It says, those who say that science can answer all questions are themselves standing outside science to make that claim. What is, we have a little bit of a of a contradiction there, of a self-refuting statement?
Yes, that's right. It would be self-referentially incoherent, because in order to assert that science can answer all questions he's claiming, you would have to be making a non-scientific claim about science. That cannot come from within science itself. It's an external claim about science that it can explain everything.
Yeah, he says you can't escape it. He continues, he says, denying metaphysics and upholding materialism must itself be a move within metaphysics. It involves standing outside the practice of science and talking of its scope. The assertion that science can explain everything can never come from within science. It is always a statement about science. So let's just continue to clear this up, Bill, as we look at this. He continues, similarly, in philosophy, the question must be pressed as to where the verificationist, who believes that a proposition is meaningful only if it can be proved true or false, stands in order to deny the possibility of metaphysics. What do you think about his
definition? That's the old line verificationism that I spoke of that dominated the first half of the 20th century in philosophy and then began to wane in mid-century and then was finally abandoned as untenable and obsolete by the end of the 20th century. This kind of verificationism, that is to say that a proposition is meaningful only if it can be proved scientifically true or false, he maintains that this sort of verificationism is untenable and that you would need to have a metaphysical perspective to hold to it.
Do you think that there is a difference between verificationism and empirical verificationism, or is that the same thing? I mean, usually when we say verificationism, we mean empirical verification.
Well, when we're thinking of philosophy, verificationism is this theory of meaning that Trigg is talking about. But obviously, when scientists are doing experimental work, they try to verify their theories through empirical evidence. But that's not the theory of verificationism, which is a theory of meaning. It would be better to say that they're committed to experimentalism, that they don't just theorize, but they go out and look for empirical evidence for their theory. And so that would be an experimentalist.
He implies that A.J. Ayer kind of tried to get around this by saying that the verification principle is an axiom. Well, he says that, though, does not settle the question of why we should choose such an axiom. It seems somewhat arbitrary and leaves open the possibility that others can just choose a different starting place without fear of rational criticism. Nothing has been solved. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't solve the problem by saying, no, empirical verification is an axiom.
Idea there is that the verification principle itself shouldn't be applied to itself. You shouldn't say, well, this statement is meaningful only if it can be proved by science to be true or false. Ayer would say, well, it's just an axiom from which you begin. You start with this as a foundational principle. And Trigg's point is, but then it just becomes arbitrary because there's no evidence for it. It's an arbitrarily adopted axiom. Why should we do that? I think that's actually understating the difficulty of the verificationist position. The fact is, this is an axiom that is utterly, utterly implausible because it would foist upon us an understanding of meaning that is so narrow that the vast majority of human speech and language would have to be dismissed as meaningless. And if you've seen my debate with Peter Atkins, the first one at the Carter Center in Atlanta, he's an old line verificationist who thinks that if a statement cannot be scientifically proven, then it's just meaningless. And in that debate, I list something like five different fields of study, including mathematics, metaphysics, aesthetics, ethics, and so forth, in which there are clearly meaningful statements that cannot be verified or falsified through empirical science. And he has little response to that.
Buckley, William F. Buckley, after you listed those five, he said, put that in your pipe and smoke it.
Exactly.
I mean, he was pretty impressed by that.
So Trigg is quite right here. This would just be an arbitrary convention which the verificationists might adopt, but then would leave us saddled with an utterly implausible theory of meaning.
Well, he goes on to say that philosophers have talked about the impossibility of a God's eye view. That is, none of us can stand outside all human understanding and conceptual schemes and talk of what there is or could be. We are all anchored where we are. He said this is a truism, but it can quickly result in questioning the possibility of any detached reasoning. And that's one of the things that those who really, well, you know, they promote scientism, Bill. That's what they really try to claim as a hallmark of science, is that it is detached reasoning. It's totally objective. Mm-hmm. You know, it gets rid of all the subjective elements to it.
Now, Trigg wants to defend the objectivity of knowledge and reasoning here. He admits that we all are anchored in our language in particular and the cognitive frameworks out of which we work, but he doesn't agree that this leads to a kind of relativity of truth and knowledge. In fact, if you think about it, that statement, none of us can stand outside all human understanding and conceptual schemes and talk of what there is or could be, is that statement made simply from within a particular conceptual scheme? If so, well, then it's not objectively binding and we don't need to agree with it. But if it is true in an objective sense, independent of a conceptual scheme, then it's false that it leads to any kind of relativity or non-objectivity. Even though we proceed from within our conceptual frameworks and language, that's not a good reason to deny that we can get at objective truth and know the way the world is. In fact, I think that very often through language and conceptual schemes we can latch on to the way the world is and understand reality.
It reminds me of the old, when someone makes the claim, which you hear quite often, there's nothing beyond the human mind, there's nothing outside of the human mind. Well, you'd have to go outside of the human mind in order to determine that. In other words, you've been there and come back and say there's nothing there, but then you've gone beyond the human mind.
That's very much in the spirit of Trigg's critique, is that in order to make these statements, you have to assume an extra scientific standpoint, which the position prohibits your taking. It wants to say science gives all the answers, you're stuck within your scientific framework, and therefore you cannot make these kind of extra or external statements. And as you point out, in order to say that there is no objective truth, that there's nothing that science can't get at or nothing beyond human mind, you're already assuming that external standpoint. Mm.
And this next paragraph, Bill, he really gets into an area that you've been looking at. He starts talking about mathematics. Mm. He says, mathematics, though, could be claimed to be merely a tool created by the human mind. Why, then, should we assume that it can express in compressible form the workings of physical reality? Those like Max Tegmark, who assume that the nature of reality is mathematical, are making a jump between symbols that seem to be the creation of mind and a reality that not only exists independently of our knowledge of it, but also far outstrips any possible knowledge. Let me get to the crux of it here. Tegmark explains the utility of mathematics for describing the physical world as a natural consequence of the fact that the latter is a mathematical structure and we're simply uncovering this bit by bit.
He's raising the question of the applicability of mathematics. Why is it that a mathematical theorist like Peter Higgs can sit down at his desk and by figuring out solutions to mathematical equations on paper, predict the existence of a particle which experimentalists then go out and, after investing millions of dollars and thousands of man hours, manage to discover, namely the Higgs boson. How is it that mathematics is the key to reality, physical reality, in this way? Now, Trigg seems to think of mathematics as just a creation of the human mind, a tool that we have made, and that would make it odd why it should describe a reality that exists independently of our mind. I don't think that that's essential to the argument here at all. I'm not inclined to think that mathematics is a creation of the human mind and just a convention that human beings have adopted. But even if you think that mathematical objects exist in some sort of a Platonic realm, that numbers and sets and functions and equations all exist, the question still is, how is it that the physical world is so structured that this abstract mathematical apparatus applies to it and describes it? And he says that Mark Tegmark explains this utility or applicability of mathematics by saying that the physical world itself has a mathematical structure. And so we're just discovering this. Well, now, I think two points can be made about that attempt to explain the utility or applicability of mathematics. First, it's simply not true. There are useful mathematical theories that have no counterparts in the structure of reality. For example, in quantum mechanics, physicists use something called Hilbert space. This is a purely logical space that is infinite dimensional. It has no counterpart in the physical world whatsoever. And yet, using Hilbert space is an indispensable and fruitful tool for understanding the world as quantum physics describes it. So you cannot explain the applicability or utility of Hilbert space by saying that the physical world meshes up with it in its structure. But secondly, even for those mathematical structures that do find counterparts in the world, like, say, elementary arithmetic, the natural numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, that the world is built in such a way that 2 plus 2 equals 4. The question still is then, why is the physical world built on this mathematical structure? Granted, if you say that the physical world is imbued with this mathematical structure, then that would explain why mathematics applies to it. But it doesn't explain why the physical world has that mathematical structure. And here, I think that the answer is most plausibly found in theism, that God has created the world in such a way that it has both a mathematical structure and also is so built or so constructed that these various mathematical theories like Hilbert space are applicable to it and therefore useful in describing it. And that would be the case whether you think mathematics is just a human invention, as Trigg seems to, or whether you think mathematics and mathematical objects exists independently of the human mind in the way the Platonist does. In either case, the explanation for the applicability of mathematics to the physical world will lie in the mind which designed physical reality to mesh up with such a structure and to be describable by such structures.
Well, we hear so much, especially those who would embrace some form of scientism, so common today, Bill, that science is the only way to discover reality. But he quotes Jim Baggett here. He says, reality is a metaphysical concept, is a metaphysical, and is such beyond the reach of science. He points out that scientific realists assume that reality and its entities exist objectively and independently of perception or measurement. He continues, reality gives science a goal and a purpose. Science has to be in the business of discovery.
Yeah, I think what he's saying there is, again, that if the scientist does really want to describe the way reality is, that reality is a metaphysical thing to which science can be applicable and can discover. And so this reality exists independently of science, and science is one of the ways to try to find out the way this reality is. And I would say that science does an excellent job in telling us much about the way the world is. That's not to say that we should be naive scientific realism. My own work on God and abstract objects has helped me to realize the degree to which even our best scientific theories are shot through with useful fictions, things like idealizations, like ideal fluids and ideal gases composed of an infinity of points, which no real fluid or gas is like, mm-hmm. or a frictionless plane, or points at infinity. There are all sorts of idealizations, and then also theoretical entities like the Higgs boson before the experimentalists found evidence of it, which science postulates, but which are not provable by science and may even be known to be false, may even be known to be just useful fictions. So science shouldn't be thought of in a naive way as just giving us a picture of reality, but I do think that it does give us insights into the way the world is. A kind of critical realism, I think, would be the best position to take.
By the way, he mentions Kant here. Anytime I see, I'm reading something and I see Immanuel Kant come up, I usually run from the room because it's so deep. But he asks, if we are embedded in a reality that can be beyond our reach, how can we hope to achieve any knowledge at all? Perhaps Kant was right, and what we think we know may simply reflect the categories of the human mind. We can perhaps only deal with things as they appear to us. How things are in themselves may forever be beyond our grasp. I wanted to bring that up, Bill, because I just wanted to see if you could maybe talk a little bit about what Kant meant by the categories of the mind.
Well, Kant believed that we have certain inherent cognitive categories that we bring to the world when we look at it. For example, we put things in space and time. On Kant's view, you can't really say that things really exist in space and time. This is something that the mind imposes on reality. Mm-hmm. And he thought there were a number of other categories that the mind imposes on reality in order to structure it in this way. And so Kant has this bifurcation between appearance and reality. The way things appear to us, and then the way things are in themselves. And he denied that we have any knowledge of things in themselves. All we have is knowledge of things as they appear to us. Mm-hmm. Well, now, as Stuart Hackett argues, I think convincingly, in his book, The Resurrection of Theism, this view is really, again, self-referentially incoherent. In order to say that there are things in themselves, and Kant did believe that, you have to already have gotten beyond the realm of mere appearance in order to assert that there's this distinction between things in themselves and things as they appear to us. You've already taken that external standpoint that Trigg is talking about. Moreover, what Hackett points out is that if the categories that we use to understand reality are categories in which reality itself is structured, then they will mesh up. And we will have an understanding of the way reality is. This is rather similar to what Tegmark said about reality having a mathematical structure in it, so that when we use our mathematics, then mathematics will apply to reality. And the same would be true with these Kantian categories. If God has so structured the world that these mental categories line up with the way the world is, then far from making us skeptical about knowing things as they are in themselves, this will actually be the means by which we could know reality as it is in itself.
On theism, God would create the universe in such a way as it could be discovered. Maybe not all at once, but he seems to have made things discoverable. We can discover.
That certainly has been the mainstream Christian position, that God as a rational creator has made a universe that is amenable to rational exploration and discovery, and this helps to motivate the whole project of modern science. Whereas on this Kantian skeptical view, honestly, it's more like Hinduism, that all we see is the world of appearance, but we do not know reality, the reality behind the appearance. And I think that view is both, in a sense, self-refuting and also unprovable, because it just assumes that the categories that the mind brings to experience are not also categories of reality itself. And if they are, then we can know more than just appearance. We can know reality. And as you say, the Christian position traditionally has been that that's the way God has made the world, as well as the soul, so that we can know the world.
Yeah, yeah. And that's a good thing, because we get to discover.
Yeah.
And we get to participate.
It validates the project of science.
Yes, yes, it does. I don't run from the room quite as fast when David Hume is brought up, but he's brought up here. David Hume, an empiricist philosopher in the 18th century, tried to remove the need for metaphysics by saying that our reasoning concerning the uniformity of nature is not grounded in the character of reality. It is, he says, not reason, which is the guide of life, but custom. We merely expect the future to resemble the past, for example.
This is the old problem of inductive reasoning. Just because every time you've observed A happen in the past, that it's been followed by B, Hume says, how do you know that tomorrow when A occurs, it will be followed by B? And if you say, well, every time in the past, A has been followed by B, and that gives me some grounds for thinking that it will be tomorrow, Hume will say, well, how do you know that you're not just at the beginning of a long series of chaotic A's and C's and D's and other things, but just the first segment of the series is structured A, B, A, B, A, B, A, B, and that's soon going to terminate. And so it would lead to a skepticism about all inductive reasoning, thereby undermining the project of science itself. And whatever else might be said about this, I think, again, the theist will maintain that God has so structured the world that inductive reasoning will apply, and that the world will not descend into a sort of chaos, but that it is a world that's amenable to this kind of inductive inference.
He brings this paragraph to a close here, saying, science becomes more the expression of human nature and our preference for the familiar than a quest for knowledge. We describe what happens and give up looking for any deeper explanation as to why it does.
Right, that would be his critique of the Humean view, that it ultimately undermines science as a quest for knowledge about the world.
He says, concluding here, there is such a thing as scientific progress, and it happens through systematic trial and error. A scientific realist has to be wary, though, about how such realism is defined. A realism that makes reality what contemporary science says it is links reality logically to the human minds of the present day. Science is then just a human product rooted in time and place. Bringing in future science or ideal science may sound more plausible, but even then there is a distinction between science reflecting or corresponding to the nature of reality and it being simply a human construction. Even the greatest scientists, such as Einstein, have seen that the intelligibility of the world is a mystery.
Mm-hmm. Yes, if you say that there is a reality which is not just constructed by science, but rather uncovered or discovered by science, then he says the question arises, why does reality have a character that enables it to be understood scientifically? And he says this, like the way in which mathematics seems to map the intrinsic rational structure of the physical world, this is presupposed within science and cannot be given a scientific explanation. It appears to be a metaphysical fact, and the explanation for which, if there can be one, must come from beyond science. And I, as a theist, would say the explanation is to be found in God. This is indeed a metaphysical explanation for both the mathematical and rational structure of the physical world, which is presupposed by science and makes science possible. And this shows that in order to justify science, I think theism provides a plausible grounding.
Yeah. Bill, let me conclude today by asking you one of those Sunday school questions. Do you think that when we get to heaven, the new heaven and the new earth, that we will have all the answers? We tend to think, the reason I'm asking that is because, well, Paul said right now we see through a glass darkly, but then we'll know. You got to put that in context. But kids seem to think that, and I've always kind of thought that as a kid. When you get there, you're going to have all the answers. You're going to know how all this works. But now I've kind of changed that. And God is infinite. We will remain finite even then. And we can discover God from now on.
Right. You could go on, if it truly is infinite, you could embark upon an infinite exploration of truth and ever deeper insights into the nature of reality.
I like that a lot better. I like the discovery than just knowing it all.
Okay.
Our whole universe was in a hot, dense state that nearly 14 billion years ago expansion started. Wait, the earth began to cool, the autotrophs began to drool, Neanderthals developed tools, we built a wall. We built the pyramids, math, science, history, unraveling the mystery that all started with a big bang. Hey! Said religion or astronomy.